Okay, we're recording. Good. Okay, so this is Daniel and I. My name is Michael, and we had some very interesting lunchtime discussions over the past year or so.
Almost a year, yeah.
Yeah, and we had so much fun with them, and we always left thinking, wow, I wish I had written this down or we had recorded this, because it seemed like we went interesting places, talking about culture,
mountains,
psychology, why we do things.
Zazen.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so then Daniel said last time, he said, hey, next time we have lunch, we should record it.
Yeah.
So I bought this voice recorder, and turns out I was pretty excited to do this.
Yeah, so in the beginning we thought, all we can discuss right now, is it better to have a transcript and a blog or just a podcast?
Yeah, right. So I think I have some feelings about that, like why maybe a podcast is better.
Yeah.
I forgot who said it, but sometime I read somebody saying that they trusted the spoken word more than the written word.
Oh, right, okay. That makes sense.
Just for one thing, when you speak, you have the chance to think out what you're saying as you go. So if you make a recording of your thoughts, of your conversation, that is the actual moment when maybe an idea comes into existence.
And when you have a blog, then the text might be cleaned up already.
So yeah.
It doesn't reveal the thoughts and the things between the lines.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And we have so much text in the world.
Yeah.
I spend a lot of time reading. I read everything, and I read way too much, and I should stop.
Okay, then just record it and put it somewhere as a podcast.
Indeed. Yeah. I think as a podcast, less people will know about it than if it was written down.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But on the other hand, maybe you get people in a different kind of moment. You know, maybe this is what they do when they're riding on a train. They might listen to something, or they're walking.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And man, if somebody could hear what, if somebody could hear something good in what we're saying while they're walking through nature or something, well, that would be amazing. Because then I think they would be joining us in this conversation.
Right, yeah. And I think reading is also fascinating, but reading uses more energy. You have to focus on the written words.
Yeah.
And when you just listen, sometimes your thoughts, they can go somewhere else, and you unconsciously still listening.
Yeah. So it's kind of like I want us to be the kind of a music in the back, and people are doing something else as they usually are with a podcast. Oh, like when I listen to a podcast, I'm always like driving or I'm walking or something. They might be in a kind of stimulable creative state where some idea that we touch on awakens a thought in them.
Right, and it's important nowadays to optimize time, right? So the time you have, you use, so you can do two things in parallel.
That's right.
When you just read, then it's one thing, and you don't have time for another thing. So,
indeed. So we are contributing to the overall efficiency of the human race, because it's essential that we all do more, ever more.
Yes.
And at key pauses, we can introduce commercial breaks and make a lot of money.
By
flogging advertisements.
Then we can even do more podcasts because we don't need to work anymore. So.
Right. And then an empire. And then, of course, we'll get out of the podcasting game entirely. We'll leave that to others.
Right,
We'll sit atop a media empire and get on to the real work.
All right, yeah. Hmm. Sounds good.
So maybe something else about us. We are both technology professionals. Yes, we work in the computing industry. And we live in Munich,
yeah.
Germany. And I'm American. I came here almost, well, I came here 12 years ago now from Seattle. And I grew up in Texas before that. But I love it here yeah. in Germany. It's amazing.
It's the most beautiful city I was born in. So yeah. I'm from Munich.
You were actually born in the city. Awesome.
Right. In Lyme.
Wow, yeah.
It's not far away
from here.
This location, right?
Yes. Oh.
So, and I grew up in Munich, first 6 years of my life, and then we moved out a little bit, 20 kilometers to the west, because it was a little bit cheaper for a big family to rent an apartment. And then I decided to go back. And then, as Mike already said, we're both computer scientists. Mike is a little bit more a computer scientist, right?
I work more often with the tiniest of bits.
Yeah.
Which is not not a praiseworthy thing. but yeah, that's right. And so lately we've both been interested in Zen.
Yeah.
So we thought we might talk about that some today. I was in Japan a week ago, and I went to a Rinzai Zen monastery, and I stayed there for 4 days, three nights, 4 days.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And
oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah. So I'm just trying to follow through on
what
we talk
do?
About.
Just eat rice and meditate, or and practice Zen, or
those were components of the experience. There were about 4 hours of sitting a day.
Okay. Was it for free the entire stay?
No, I had to pay about 30 euros a day.
Okay, that's almost for free.
Yeah, just to cover, you know, the food, because they provide me with food and stuff. The food is, they have a garden, and I helped with the garden.
Yeah.
There would be about 2 hours a day of doing work.
Yeah.
You know, either in the garden outside, or one day it was raining, so I vacuumed the temple.
Nice. Where was it?
It was outside of Kyoto.
Okay.
I forgot the name of the little town, but it's west of Kyoto by like 30 minutes.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
On the edge of the country. It's a small town. There was the temple. There was another temple nearby. There was a guest house where I slept.
Yeah.
All of these were like 5 minutes walk away from each other, a lot of fields and countryside, and everybody just leaves the doors of everything open.
Yeah.
You just sort of wander in and out. And right outside there were hills covered in forest, and I quite wanted to go and walk in those hills, but there really just wasn't time.
Did you search for it before you went to Japan, or did you accidentally find it?
I looked on the internet. I looked for something like, you know, Zen monastery English or Zen monastery
stay. So that would be my second question. How did you talk about what to do? So I assume you don't speak Japanese,
right? No.
So it was English then.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, here's how I was lucky. The first place I wrote to, they had a website.
Yeah.
It was kind of an outdated website. It had used frames.
What?
You don't see frames much anymore.
Back in the 90s.
Yeah. They said, okay, you can come and stay here at this time or this time or this time.
Okay.
You know, and the time I was in Japan, I was there for work, never fit into any of those. So then I think it also said on the website something like, oh, okay, but just email us if for whatever. So I emailed them and asked about staying there, just saying that I'm kind of a beginning Zen student, and I'd just love to stay a few days at a monastery. The next day, this great guy named Gyonin wrote back to me. He's like the head. He's the head monk of this temple, and he's from Mexico actually, and he, you know, he speaks English and he speaks Japanese really well, and so Gyonin said, it'll be empty, basically. It'll just be he and I. Mm-hmm. But we'll also see the Roshi, who's the enlightened man, yeah. who's kind of in charge of that temple and a few others.
What did it feel to meet someone who is, let's call it enlightened, or how were the conversations with this?
Yeah, his name is Hozumi, so they call him Hozumi Roshi. Mm-hmm. This was after 2 days I was there, and then one morning at 5 a.m, this is when you open the temple, and you chant and sing for about 45 minutes, going through these chants. They may be a sutra, like a Buddhist sutra about something important, the vows or the Eightfold Path or some of these other important ideas. But you chant it in Japanese. So I had a little book that I could follow the syllables and say the right thing. And Gyonin had much of it memorized, but not all of it. And so he's sitting there and he's chanting and he's ringing a gong and a bell at different key times.
Yeah.
And I have to join in, and then I have to not join in and then join in. And there's like a lot of rules around how do you step into the temple? How do you exit the temple? How do you pay the proper respects?
Yeah.
So my head was full of like learning all these things. And Gyonin was very patient, but he had his work cut out for him because I'm not a fast learner. So on the second day, we went over to the other temple, mm-hmm. And met Hozumi Roshi, and we sat with him and talked for a while. He's traveled to the West a lot over the last decades of his life. He's around 80 years old. So his job, in a way, is outreach between Buddhism and Western religions, like Catholicism.
Yeah, that's something I read in the book Zen Minds, Beginner's Mind, is that Buddhism is not just another religion that's stands by itself. It's a contribution, or it's an add-on to other religions, because it doesn't
you could deny run it that way.
God. Yeah. It doesn't deny, don't know, whatever the other religions want to tell you.
That's right.
That's pretty amazing with Buddhism. So you can be a Buddhist, in parallel to being a Christ, for example.
I think so. Like a Christian,
A Christian, Christ, Christ
can be, I think there's probably a lot of variation in that. My impression is that there are some places where Buddhism is practiced with a full constellation of gods and goddesses and stories and all kinds of things.
Yeah.
But something neat about Zen is that it's Alan Watts said that Zen is Buddhism stripped for export.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Which is, it's kind of like, it's like a back to the basics. It's like a really simple thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so
it's the core of Buddhism and what Buddha is.
Yeah. And it's a focus on the present moment, and a kind of deprecation of or de-emphasis on stories, you know, of things that happened in time.
Yeah.
You know, there is a central story. The story of Buddha's awakening is kind of the prototypical story of enlightenment for anybody interested in Zen. Yeah. So I think this is the only story that's really important.
Yeah.
You should know that and take some inspiration from it.
Yeah.
Do you know that basic story of Buddhism?
No.
Ah, well then I can just sketch it briefly.
Yeah.
Okay. A man named Shakyamuni. I'm going to get all this wrong.
Yeah.
There was a man, and he was a prince, and his father was a king in a small kingdom in India, and He grew up in a sheltered way, yeah, as you could imagine. You know, private schools and everything. I'm just joking there, but one day he learned that there is death and that there was suffering. He went out one day and he saw a beggar dying and all kinds of stuff. And this caused him to ask why. And he just kept asking why. And as this does to the rest of us, you know, it led him on some kind of quest to understand the world in depth. You know, what are we? Yeah. What is this? And he became a seeker, mm-hmm, the way we might often. Mm-hmm. He tried all kinds of religions that were popular at the time. And they often, you know, in their strongest forms, they ended up saying things like, hey, you should starve yourself. You know, sit there, starve yourself. You'll experience visions. You'll see the truth. And he did some of that stuff. But the cool thing that he did that was different was he said, hey, this isn't good enough because I always come back to myself. Like, I might have an amazing vision.
Yeah.
But then I come back and try to explain it to people. And they're like, yeah.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
You're crazy.
Yeah. And then even he himself would forget it.
Yeah.
And I've actually had experiences like this. I think, you know, I got into astral projection a few years ago. I experienced this stuff. It was amazing. I loved it. And I told people about it. And I was bummed out that they couldn't, no matter how much they might love me or something, they're like, yeah, that's your thing. That's you saw something weird. and it's sad, right? Because I wanted to communicate this idea of something I saw. It becomes a story even for me.
Yeah.
I look back, this was like 5 years ago. I look back on that and I'm like, yeah, that was cool. But it's a big hassle.
Yeah.
If you want to astral project, you can. But you have to devote a lot of time to it. You have to say, every night I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to follow these rules and I'm going to get up at 5 and I'm going to move to a couch and then I'm going to go back to sleep, but I'm going to think. That's
too much to do.
It is. It really is for a life, you know? Yeah. I mean, our lives are busy and it's kind of like a diet, like a special diet.
Yeah,
you can do it and you'll lose weight for a while, but then you have to come back to your regular life.
Yeah.
And that was something that Buddha saw. It's a really cool insight. And so then he tried again, but this time he said, there's just me and there's just the present moment.
Yeah.
And again, I will sit, but I'm not going to starve myself.
Yeah.
And so this has this idea, that's the idea of the middle way. You know, Buddhism, over and over, it avoids extremes.
Yeah.
It always says, hey, there's a middle path. Don't starve yourself. Don't eat too much.
One effect of starving is you will start to just focus on yourself and what you feel and what you think. So maybe just starving was a catalizator?
Yeah. And that's an interesting idea. It's kind of like you need to make mistakes in order to have something to play with.
Yeah.
There's a neat idea in Buddhism that your mistakes become kind of the weeds which you then feed into the ground to make the soil rich. Whoa, there's a fire alarm. Perhaps what we've been discussing is controversial enough that the building staff has been alerted.
They want to kick us out.
Yeah, unfortunately, we have to cut it short.
Yeah,
but come on. Okay, so now we're outside, and we might have a problem with wind, but let's try anyway. We'll at least we'll at least get these ideas. So go with. So just to finish up, the Buddha sat and he became enlightened. He realized that we are all connected, and that's a wonderful realization. And there's a lot more to it. And later I can go on and talk a little more about some of the stuff I saw at the monastery.
Yeah, that will be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, but for now, we also have both read Suzuki's book, Zen Mind, Beginner Mind.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing book. And Daniel, you had a thought on it.
Two things. Because we were talking about Buddha, what is enlightenment, and so Mike said, when you know that everything is connected, then you probably are enlightened. And one another aspect is that you just understand that you do things because you do it. So you sit because you sit. You practice because you practice, with no specific goal in mind, with no purpose. You just do it for the sake of doing it.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, the most frequent phrase you can find in that book.
Yeah.
So you just breathe because you breathe. So this led us to the conversation about goals, because the book says, or Zen itself says, when you practice, you should practice without a goal in mind. So, for example, I practice a Zen to become relaxed, to become happy, to whatever, to become enlightened.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You just do it because you do it. And the question was, how would I even start practicing when there's no goal, right?
Right, right.
So
it's, yeah.
And then Suzuki said there are, I think it was 4 levels.
Right.
Whereas the highest level, 4, is where you just do it because you do it.
Right, right. That's right. Like probably the first level he meant was something like, you decided to sit because, I don't know, someone told you you would be more relaxed.
Yeah.
And then it sort of goes up like that. Oh, there was another one that's pretty interesting where he said, aha, there's another one way of sitting, or one reason for sitting, is to develop powers, magical powers.
Yeah.
He said, like, or even to be... One thing I heard about it was that you might want to be reborn into strange heavens, different heavens. But I think Suzuki said that would be terrible, though. I mean, why would you want that? You'll get lazy if that happens.
The wind.
Yeah, the wind is probably messing us up. But I like that idea a lot, of choosing the highest reason to sit, which is just to sit.
Yeah.
There's a intentionality there that I think is really pure.
Yeah.
It's kind of like you're saying, hey, I don't just want to get something, I want to understand.
Yeah.
I want to understand in the fullest sense, what is this world? Where, who are we?
So that means, let's keep the level thing, right? That means from level 1, where you just, where you get excited, where someone tells you you should practice it because of this and that.
Yeah.
Then you pass the frustration level, then you pass the happiness level, and then finally top level would be no goal.
Yeah.
And just you do it because you do it. So that means in the beginning you always have an intention or a goal, and the goal disappears.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Like you're just saying, as a beginner to Zen in general, it's impossible to remove goals from your mind.
Yeah, right.
You know that as a theoretical good idea, it would be that you should sit without any real reason.
Yeah.
But if you're honest with yourself, you do come with a reason.
Yeah, right.
You know? Your idea of ascending through levels, I think, is a natural process that that can and should unfold.
Yeah.
As you sit, the goals will bleed away, because sitting is what you do.
Yeah.
You know, you built it by habit, and you may have some sense that it's good for you. Maybe something comes.
So probably there is a goal the goal is to have no goal.
Yeah, yeah.
In the end, yeah. Right.
But
sometimes I compare to the work we do. Let's, for example, coding.
Yeah.
In the beginning, you want to do it because you're fascinated by it. You you want to earn money, right?
Right.
Several years or decades ago, they said, yeah, okay, if you are a computer scientist, you have to code because you earn a lot of money.
Right,
and
right.
So you start doing it because maybe of this fact or the fact that it's really fun.
Or you grew up watching movies, yeah, about, right, TIE Fighters, yeah, and X-Wings, and you wanted to be part of that technology, yeah, world. Yeah.
Then you go through frustration. Damn it, I don't get it. Why? How can I do? How can I implement this? How does this one thing work? And so on. Then it's happiness. And then maybe at some time it's just, you just code because you code.
Right, right. And then you'll be disillusioned at some point.
Yeah.
You'll say, oh, all I did was make the world more complicated.
Yeah, right, yes.
And then you'll say, but I'm too old to go back to school, yeah, and change, right, careers. So
maybe that's the difference between coding and Zazen. Because in Zazen, you don't think in the end, well, all I did is just crap. Right?
I don't know. I think you do think that.
Okay,
I remember, yeah, a story. But when you think it, you're laughing at,
yeah,
the same time. There's a story of a Zen master who died, and he said something like, "All I did with my life was sell water, sitting by the river."
All right. Yeah. Okay.
So.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I see. Okay.
But he was smiling when he said that.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
It's like. So what? It's silly. And life is silly. Like, we think we want to end our lives and look back and say,
yeah,
look, I built an enormous edifice.
Yeah.
But all edifices fall down in time.
Yeah.
And an edifice, something great and big that you think helped the world.
Yeah.
It's probably already hurting people even before you die.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And
yes,
it's a thing in the world, and thank goodness things in the world fall down.
Yeah.
So I think Zen is a way of accepting that and laughing about it and,
yeah,
holding it.
That's true. So you have some parallels between programming, coding, and Zazen, and finally,
yeah,
Zazen is helping you to overcome the frustrations you have with coding.
Yeah, right. Right. A way, yeah, to accept, to realize,
to accept, yeah,
to realize that you did things,
yeah,
and what you did is in the end not such a big deal.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I like that. That I definitely feel that way. So I'm 46 years old, and I think that when I turned 40 or so,
yeah,
it definitely happened that I got more interested in this stuff.
Yeah.
Part of the reason, really, was that I saw the ends of certain stories.
Yeah.
You know, until then, I lived with always like, yeah, I'm going to move on from success A to,
yeah,
success B.
Right.
And I climbed that mountain, and now I will climb the next one. But after a while, you see, well, these mountains are all kind of the same.
Yeah.
And you lose the motivation to live that way,
yeah,
anymore. To live like always looking forward to the new.
Yeah.
And so then you want to live with depth. You want to live,
yeah,
with like, hey, I may not do anything new or amazing.
Right, yeah.
But maybe I'll do one thing well.
Yeah,
know?
Right, yes.
Or one thing with depth. And so that's why Zen really resonates for me. I hear the,
yeah,
people talking about like drinking tea, you know, with conviction.
Yes.
And I say like, yeah, you know, that's my story lies in that,
yeah,
direction. There's an end to being like a kid in the world and seeing like that there's always a new,
yeah,
copy of what you did before.
I think I'm still in the progress. So I'm
yeah,
39 at the moment, and I start to realize that everything you do is, yeah, not boring, but it doesn't make a change. It doesn't.
Yeah, yeah.
It doesn't. The world is. There's no benefit for,
right,
the people. There's no benefit for my family, for my kids.
Yeah.
So,
maybe I should just. You get money, and
you
this helps you,
that's
provide,
okay, yeah,
for your,
right,
family.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's one effect. But I mean, when I was younger, I always had in mind, I need to do this. I want to create this. I want to
create my own app, my own code, my own program, doing this fancy stuff.
Right.
Because then I'm successful and I can change the world. But this doesn't happen, right? Just maybe one of 1 million.
Right.
One out of a million, maybe.
What actually happens with all of those efforts to change the world is that you make the world crowded.
Yeah.
Because it's not just you. It's we're all doing
it's
that.
Everyone, yeah.
And so another thing I like, a metaphor that I have in the back of my head, is that my identification moves away from the mountains to the valley. And so when you're looking at a mountain, your mind is full of the physicality of it.
Ah, I see.
And the fact that you're excited to do the work, to climb it, to win, or to make your own mountain, whatever.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But when you start...
Your mental mountain.
Yeah,
Did you say that? Mental?
Sure, yeah. The coding that we do or things like that, these are mental mountains.
Yeah, right.
But when you identify with the valley, what you're looking at mostly is space.
Yeah.
The valley mostly is like a big area of space where then people build little houses and stuff.
Right, yeah.
And
that's a nice thought.
Yeah, what I'd like to do then now is build valleys for people. Like big areas of space where they can have a hell of a good time and they can build their lives.
That's a nice phrase, build valleys for people. That's good.
Yeah.
I don't build houses for people. I don't build tools or cars for people.
Yeah.
I build valleys.
Right.
That's brilliant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you start to identify with the space in the world that allows all of this stuff to be. So here we are. We're sitting in this field, and it's a beautiful day here in Munich, and everybody's outside because of the fire alarm. And people... It's great. Everybody's talking. Here's some dogs. People have room to be out here, and that's nice.
Ugh. That reminds me of a conversation we had a couple of times ago. I think last time or I don't know. We were talking about also about space and giving. Giving space to people or building space for your kids.
Yeah, right.
So you shouldn't block their way, their how can I say that? You shouldn't build walls and boundaries and mountains, and you shouldn't teach them how to climb up the mountains, go on the top of the mountain, then you're a hero.
Yeah.
You should instead build the valley and show them about the beauty of space, right? Where they can grow, where they can be whatever they want to be.
Yeah.
Right.
And give I think of it like this: like give them space.
Yeah.
And the phase of life that kids are in is the one that we're leaving.
Yeah.
It's the phase of if you give me space, I will build a mountain.
Yeah.
In it. And that's fine, and that's what they should do.
Which I climbed myself. I built my own mountain, and I climbed it myself.
Right.
And no one has any... That's now... So that's what you think when you're younger. And now we think, okay, we start to think, I built the mountain, I climbed it.
Yeah.
But, for what?
Yeah, right. Like, it was fun, but now... there's another horizon. This is... We grow and change, and that's okay. Suzuki in this book he talks about there's this lovely thing that I really like where he says the way to control someone that's kind of a silly, it's a funny way of saying it.
I can remember that.
The way to control someone is to have them feel mischievous, to allow them to feel like if you feel mischievous, you feel free. You're kind of like, I could do all kinds of things. Here, I'm going to tweak your nose, and I'm going to run off over here, and ha-ha. Like, that's real freedom.
Yeah.
And he says, give a sheep a large field.
Yeah.
That's a way to control the sheep.
Yeah, right.
And then just watch the sheep in their field.
Yeah.
Like, you're not hurting them. The sheep is crazy happy with the big field.
From time to time, you just have to check that the sheep is still within the boundaries a little bit,
right.
But if the sheep decides to jump over it, okay, could be a problem, but
that might be okay too. Yeah. Maybe the sheep is showing you another field right, yeah. that you should have. But it's way, yeah, he said the best way is just to watch
yeah.
people. The second best way is to try to control them, like actually saying, you know, no, you should stay here or there.
Yeah.
Clearly that's not good. The third way, the worst way is to ignore people.
Yeah.
And that's interesting. And that's again this balance in Buddhism. You want to leave people alone.
Yeah.
But if you ignore them, that's not good either.
No, right, yeah. I'm always, when we talk about this space thing and so, and boundaries, I always think about my kids. Because in the beginning, my how I wanted to raise my kids is, or was, just give them very... a wide range uh-huh. with limited, just a few boundaries.
Yeah.
And then from time to time, make them bounce.
Yeah.
Bounce back.
Yeah.
Right?
Stay
within the boundaries, uh-huh. but then let them experience
That's
the
good.
Space themselves.
That's good.
But when you don't, when you stop thinking about this or is believing in this, or you just, because the time is stressful or you start to narrow the space.
Yeah, yeah.
You automatically start to narrow the space, and then you always yell at the kids, you punish them.
Right.
You have to...
That's interesting. And notice, yeah. you know, it had nothing to do with the kid.
Yeah.
It was like
right.
you felt yeah. short on time.
Yeah.
You had this kind of fear come into your life.
Yeah.
And so then you look back at them and you're like, clearly... This is too much freedom.
Yeah. yeah, right, okay.
And you sort of narrow their yeah. boundaries and you want to impose more control.
What Suzuki also said in the book is when there is a horse and a carriage and
yeah.
The carriage, it's slow, whom would you punish or who would you look at, the horse or the carriage?
Yeah.
So you or the kids or you and your environment.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not the carriage.
Right, right.
So, yeah, it's always you.
That's right, it's yeah. always you. Yeah. So I love this space thing,
yeah.
you know. You know, I use, because I am a mountain climber too, and I love climbing actual mountains, and it's nice that we can use mountains as metaphors as well. But I used to think that I climbed it, and I love to look down at all the stuff.
Yeah.
But now I think I was enjoying the space. Actually, because if you're on the side of a cliff, look at the amazing like volume of
yeah.
space that's there now. That's freedom.
Yeah,
space is cool.
And also psychologically, when you look at a wall or if you're in a room,
yeah.
you get frustrated. You panic.
Yeah.
If you have kilometers, hundreds of kilometers in front of you.
Yeah.
No boundaries, no walls. Then
right.
It's
right.
This is
why civilizations must collapse.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yes.
right. They get crowded. They get
yeah.
full of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's always like somebody else's stuff.
Yeah.
You know, like oh, there was a great man once,
yeah.
and he left a lot of statues and things, and
yeah.
like we live in his idea of the good.
Yeah.
The most we can do is maybe add a chunk to it somewhere.
Yeah. Right.
And try to take pride in that, but. We have to get back to like nature and kind of start fresh.
Yeah.
That's why there's cycles.
And so, for example, I love New York and Tokyo. Tokyo is one of my favorite cities.
Yeah.
Apart from Munich.
Yeah.
But every time I spend a couple of days in one of these cities, in the beginning it's exciting, right?
Yeah.
But after 2 or 3 days, I really don't feel good. I start to feel like a lion in a cage, or
yeah.
right? Because all those huge houses, skyscrapers, there's no space.
That's right.
Right? And I wonder if everyone is a little bit, yeah, goes a little bit crazy when he's living in such a city.
I think, for me, I feel the same
yeah.
way. You know, I grew up in a small town. I wanted to live in a city.
Yeah.
Like growing up in a small town in Texas, San Francisco was like the coolest place in the world. My brother and sister
yeah.
lived there, and I would visit them. when I was 13 and 14 and 15, and I would always say, like, oh my God, that's the amazing place to be. I want to be there. But now I'm more like when I was a kid. Like, I like silence. Yeah. I like the quiet.
Yeah.
And I don't need all this stuff anymore.
No. Same here. In the beginning. So, as I said, I grew up in Munich. Then we moved to the outside of Munich.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to live in... Again, in Munich, the big city,
right?
Or even New York or Tokyo, which I could do for, let's say, 2 or 3 years. But but now, even Munich starts to become too crowded for me.
Yeah, me too.
Too noisy. Too,
me too.
Too many frustrated people yelling, the cars everywhere. Oh, it's sometimes it's terrible.
I know. For me, what happened was, in the last couple of years, I noticed... that if I suddenly want to go out to a restaurant, you can't because they're mad that you don't have a reservation.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Like, and they'll say, oh, in 2 hours or something ridiculous. So
it's Wednesday. Yeah, so what?
Yeah. And that's one of the small joys of living here, of just saying like, ah, look, it's small enough and big enough. It's like just right.
Yeah,
but then for me that dial did kind of move, and I would like to live outside the city.
Yeah,
I do like my tiny commute that I can walk to work. That's awesome. But
that's one thing. Yeah, when you live in Munich, you have the Gasteig-Brings where you can see theaters, go to the theaters, see some musicians or music concerts.
Yeah,
right?
It is nice.
When you live outside, it's just you.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is, I think, pretty hard in the beginning, but then you start to enjoy it.
Probably. Indeed. Yeah. That's kind of where I am now. Like, this monastery I stayed at, every night was so amazing. It was like these crickets and some frogs. You'd hear them. It gets dark. Because we would sit for 2 hours and meditate from 7 to 9.
Wow.
And so you see the lights go down. And it's an amazing sense of freedom and peace. But maybe we should call this one short. Lunch break is over.
Yeah.
It's time to go back to work.
Okay. Yeah.
And so if it works out right, if the wind wasn't too bad, then I think we should just put this out there.
Yeah.
And maybe some folks interested in Buddhism or just living in the world
and
at
we
this
come
time.
Back soon.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Mike.
Okay.